And Julia Balligan from LSE and, oh, from Lancaster.
Yeah.
Great,
yeah.
Super.
Okay, so a small caveat on this paper before I start is that this paper, when eventually it's written, is going to be aimed at the Journal of Management Studies. So some of the stuff that we're tackling in it might not seem as kind of technically CA as some of the other presentations that we've had, but it is based on rigorous and thorough CA research. Julia, I don't know if any of you are familiar with her, but isn't actually from a CA background. So we've tried to use the ideas and apply it in a way that it might be relevant for JMS. But you can interrogate me in more detail about the CA aspects if you feel that I haven't put them out to a sufficient degree. So this is based on some research that I did a number of years ago looking at tour guides in museums, and the actual initial piece of research didn't have anything to do with strategy, but going back and reinterpreting the data, having discovered the strategy as practice field, which is what SAP stands for, I became interested in the idea that these frontline workers might actually be doing something that's usefully strategic, but that isn't recognised by either the museum or by the field of strategy. And so started reinterpreting the data. That's the context in which this paper is kind of set. So museum tour guides are very clearly non-managers. Strategy as practice is very keen on micro-interactional, multimodal studies of strategic work, but self-confessedly doesn't really know how to do them. Lots of the people who are involved in strategy as practice haven't come from that background. So Samra Fredericks is one example of someone who has, the majority of other people haven't. But here there's a body of data that has access to micro-interactional, multimodal data, and additionally, UK museum strategic aims are routinely centred around the types of things that tour guides do. So I'll say a bit more about that in a moment, but tour guides are in constant interaction with the audiences, but museums routinely sideline them. They very rarely see them because they're mainly volunteers as being anything other than a kind of an added service that nobody particularly cares about, but visitors quite enjoy going on tours. So they do get very sidelined by museums. So I had already used a workplace studies approach using CA and ethnomethodology to study this kind of data. And one of the big themes that had come up was the idea that there is a certain moral order to tour guiding. It's very refreshing to be in a room where I don't have to massively describe moral order, because that can be a bit of a challenge. But just a kind of as a recap, the idea that there's a patterned social activity of a particular environment, organisation or type of interaction, which actors themselves create, recreate and orient to through their interactions. So the idea that the building blocks of what we do can be revealed by studying interaction. So I was interested in unearthing how guides in particular make sense of and give sense to the tasks of audience engagement and inclusion. So the things that they do as standard practice in the work that they carry out on a day-to-day basis. In order to gather this data, I filmed tours in the V&A Museum and in 78 Derngate. For those of you who aren't familiar with 78 Derngate, it's a Charles Rennie Mackintosh designed refurbished house in Northamptonshire, quite small, a little townhouse. You'll see that in the data, in the fact that you can see there's a lot of people packed into quite small rooms. I also trained to be a guide, so there's an ethnographic basis to the data, and hung around in the staff room for many hours while the camera was running in the rooms, talking to and interviewing guides. In the V&A, it was slightly different. I followed the guide around with the camera because the tours moved from one space to another. They've got something like 12 miles of gallery space. So I had to follow. I couldn't just wait for the guides to show up on the spot. Sorry, there's all these different themes going on, but I will be drawing them together, so bear with me. The museum missions and strategies of museums in the UK are largely centred around the need to win funding. So unless they're local authority museums who are funded as part of the local authority's budget, then they need to win funding to be able to survive on the whole. And funding comes from a very limited number of bodies. There are, of course, heaps of exceptions to that, but it's very, very small. It's like seed funding from anybody else. And so it's really only the Heritage Lottery Fund and the Arts Council that do big enough chunks of funding that anyone really bothers to write their mission statements around the basis of these. And these two bodies, and most of the other smaller ones, are interested in the same things: diversity, engagement and education. So I've been through all the mission statement strategies of the top, I think, 300 museums in the UK, and they've all got these words, these kinds of words come up over and over again. So in all of these cases, you can see that there's going to begin to be a tension between one museum trying to do all three of those things at the same time in their day-to-day practice. So there's some challenges about balancing and moderating these things too. So this is where I want to start looking at the data then, because I'm going to hopefully convince you that tour guides have an important role to play in some of this and how we can begin to see them as strategic actors who have an impact on the museum's ability to meet the strategy that they've set themselves. So the first key thing is that guides engage diverse audiences. Museum funding bodies, as I've said, routinely make their awards based on audience inclusion and engagement, but they're particularly focused on diversity. So for example, the Heritage Lottery Fund hopes that the museums that it funds will help more people and a wider range of people to take an active part in heritage. And that's one of just three criteria upon which it awards funding. So on this first fragment, fragment one on your handout, what we're going to see is a tour guide who's got a very mixed age group following her around. There's four smallish children and I think it's four adults. We're particularly interested in Max and Tom, who are these two here. And the tour guide is obviously interpreting a house that on the whole is a bit more interesting to adults. So it's a Charles Rennie Mackintosh house. It's very heavily design led. This room probably to a younger eye might look quite boring, quite brown. It even looks quite boring, quite brown to my eye as well. It's not particularly Charles Rennie Mackintosh. So they have their work cut out to try and make it engaging for young audience members. So hopefully you'll be able to see when I play this what she does to try and achieve that.
What appears to be a completely front of staff and cupboard there, kind of fits in with our practical ideas that Bassett Work had and what we were talking about earlier, the fitness for purpose, because it's actually, what can you imagine is in here? Be nice, wouldn't it? But it's actually coal. Rather than having a nasty coal bucket and on your phone.
So there you can see she's taking quite dry content and talking about this idea that Bassett, like, who owned the house, had for fitness for purpose. He thought everything should be practical and there are gaps in all the doors to get the fresh air circulating. It was built very much around the idea that your house should be a healthy place. Not particularly fascinating concepts for 8 or 9 year olds. So as she bends down to open this cupboard, she's on the same eye level as the children, and she asks them, can they see what's in there? Now, if anyone can tell me what she said, what he says in response, I've listened to this so many times, I've had dreams about it. I'm fairly sure it's mineral water. It was a very hot day, but if anyone had anything else, I would love to know afterwards. So she bends down and asks this. It's actually because the cupboard, it doesn't look like that's what it's gonna be. It looks like a normal cupboard and it hides a coal scuttle. So by doing this, the tour guide shows a kind of routine skill at engaging diverse audiences using a range of techniques. This is just one. But other types of things they do, they're using contextual talk. They'll bring in features of other members of the audience. So someone might cut their ear to show that they can't hear. They'll elaborate a point about a chandelier having 10,000 pieces, but in such a way that it makes it sound fantastically exciting to the rest of the audience and everyone else goes, wow. She'll direct her gaze at particular audience members to try and encourage them. So we see that in other types of talk too, but tour guides do that a lot. And as I say, also accounting for disabilities too. So this is just one example of what might be seen as kind of diversity in action. So we have this general kind of abstract idea of what diversity is and what kinds of things museums do to try and deal with diversity. This is a very small, very practical example how a guide has tried to draw in two diverse audiences. A second point that we could pick up on is the idea that guides balance audience enjoyment and education. So again, funding bodies routinely focus on both education and entertainment, and as Nicholas Sirota called it, edutainment, this kind of idea that your museum is just as important to have your shop and your cafe being fantastic at the moment as it is as having your gallery space being that way. So the idea of a museum as spectacle. And the Heritage Lottery Fund says that they would like museums to create spaces that present and future generations are able to experience and enjoy. That's one of the other two things that they say they're going to do. So therefore, museum strategic aims routinely do the same. In the case of the Victoria and Albert Museum, in their strategic document that is currently running, they review it every 2 years and it runs for 5 years at a time. to promote, support and develop the UK creative economy by stimulating enjoyment and appreciation of design. So you've got that, again, balance between entertainment and the practicalities of education. And that is echoed throughout their strategic document. So here we have fragments two.
And I just turn it up a little bit? I think it was a bit quiet, so I'll just turn it up the amplifier.
Thank you. This is in, it sadly no longer exists, but it was the one room left in the V&A that was still done out in the same way that it was when it first opened. So it was a beautiful room with wood flooring and everything. It's not there anymore. And the guide is talking about what you'll find on the back sheet. Back of the sheet. So it's a chair by someone called Rampendahl, and it's made of antlers and horns. And what the guide is going to do is make a bit of a joke around the fact that the audience members that she's talking to look very solemn and subdued when she points the chair out to them. So she's previously been talking about this huge cabinet, which she's called the Big Cathedral in Wood, and then she turns to look at this chair, which you can just about make out in the foreground, which is obviously a lot more grisly than the Cathedral in Wood.
Then, of course, you get the piece that has the elaborate bit without the previous style. Very solemn faces on that. this is made of deer's antlers and the mirror that goes with it, and they're white bits of boar's teeth. And
you can just see the great satisfaction she gets out of telling them that. But this tour guide is a kind of an old hand within the V&A, and it's a great example of the way that guides routinely balance conflicting aims of dispensing fun and information. So everyone probably in this room has been on a guided tour, at least one guided tour at some point, and throughout the time I was doing this research, people loved coming up to me and telling me what their best tour and the worst tour they'd ever had was. And the best tour generally seemed to do quite a good job of balancing entertainment and enjoyment with education. The worst tours are very dry and very educative. So this is a common feature of tours today, this idea of balancing education and enjoyment. Guides do other things, like laughing through serious information, which is what you see a bit of here. Turning facts into spectacle. So again, the idea, numbers become a very big feature in tour guides' work, really emphasising spectacularly large numbers about galleries of miles of gallery space and that kind of thing. And building jokes into the tour and kind of jokes and tests, sometimes both together, sometimes separately, but challenging people, what is this object? So particularly in the V&A where they've got so much space, but you also saw in the last fragment too, creating kind of puzzles or challenges which work both for adults and for children in trying to encourage engagement and entertainment at the same time as doing education. And a theme that I'm not going to go into in much detail here, but I mentioned it earlier, so I bring it up again, is the idea that audiences uphold this kind of moral order. It's not just the tour guides who do the work of educating and entertaining, but audience members play along in this role. So we know how we should carry on when we go on a guided tour, and it's really key to their success, the fact that audience members play along with this and answer the questions, laugh at the jokes, etc. It sounds kind of self-explanatory, but actually, in most work on guided tours, the role of the audience is totally disregarded, so it's quite an important point to make. And then thirdly, again, we've got a sense of balance, but actually what happens in other places, it's not just a balance between education and entertainment, but there are other kinds of mission aims or other kind of strategic aims which come into conflict at specific occasions within the guided tour. And sometimes the guide will be torn between which of the two particular things they might emphasise. So this fragment's a bit longer, but I think I've got time to play it in full. It's going to be in two parts. So this was before I invested in a fisheye lens. At the moment, the area that you can see is off to one side of where the guide is standing. It's, in a sense, the less important angle. So I'll play that one first and then the second one. What you have... Yeah, sorry that the image is quite dark.
You can turn on the light.
I think the lights at the front are out, so we won't get much more benefit by turning up all the other lights.
It's mainly the audio that you're interested in with this one, anyway, on this particular fragment, and the other part of it is much brighter. So the audience members are all walking into the room. The guide has just taken them from another room into this room, and she's waiting for them to arrange themselves around the window bay, which you'll see on the second part of the fragment, so that she can begin to talk. but she has some challenges in trying to get all of the audience members to listen to her, and so she makes a start anyway, focusing in on a particular area of the audience to direct her talk to, and treats them as what I've referred to as a working audience. So they do the work of the whole audience. When she can't get attention from everyone, it's enough to carry on with what she's doing. So I'll play it through and then tell you a bit more about it.
It does, yes. Yes. Gosh, it's changed. This is the dining room and the morning room, really. That bit is the extension. You're standing in the extension now of that. It would have finished at the edge there.
So the voice that you could hear in the previous one mainly was this person who's the tour guide, and you can see that that group of audience members didn't pay much attention to start with, but the guide continued anyway, and you'll now see who she's talking to when she's continuing, so who she's using as her working audience.
It does, yes. Gosh, it's changed. This is the dining room. And the morning room, really. That bit is the extension. You're standing in the extension now.
So the challenge that the guide has there. Sorry. The challenge that the guide's got there is she's managing potential conflicts between strategic aims. So we've talked about education and entertainment, that's kind of the obvious one. But she has other problems in trying to make sure that the audience don't feel like they have to participate in the tour, like they're being press ganged into being a part of the tour, but nonetheless she's got people to talk to, so the tour is allowed to continue and she can actually achieve the types of things that she's setting out to do. So here she slows down the pace until everyone's reoriented, balancing speed with appreciation. But other people wait to reply to audience comments until a natural break. So an audience member might ask a question or make a comment. Rather than responding to it directly, the tour guide waits until a few moments later when she can time an elaborate nod with something else that she's saying, which happens to be positive, so it allows her to do both things at once. I keep saying her because almost every tour guide in the data is female. So the idea that there's other kind of conflicts that the guides have to manage is quite important. Now, why does any of this count as strategy, I think is an important question for me to answer before I wrap up. We obviously see strategy kind of with a big S and the idea that it's the sort of thing that goes on in the boardroom, but here we have quite clear evidence that the micro actions of people on the front line in an organisation who aren't managers has a significant link, whether they realise it or not, and that's the key point, to what the organisation is doing strategically. So in the majority of cases, they don't realise it at all. They've got no idea that what they're doing has any impact. They're generally volunteers, as I said. They're run by a volunteer manager normally, who also has no idea that what's going on has an impact on the organisation's strategy. And so they end up being ignored or sidelined in a way that essentially museums who do lots of guided tours are missing a trick in being able to win funding based on that. Since I've become interested in this idea, going back and reading some other works, I actually think there's examples of this kind of micro activity having a strategic impact in other people's work, even though they don't directly recognise it. I say it's a Hochschild, and the air hostess's smile is actually a perfect example of a strategic action, and those air hostesses are strategic actors. There's another great example in a book that came out earlier this year by Fry and Morris called Uncommon Service, and they talk about how Starbucks discipline their customers into ordering their coffee with the words in exactly the right order. Now, how amazing is that as kind of a strategic activity which allows them to provide the coffee equivalent of fast food? So this idea that there are things that are going on the front line that aren't recognised by more senior members of an organisation is potentially a really powerful impact that CA could have for the strategy as practice field. And they are scrabbling around, as I say, to some degree at the moment, to work out how they're going to do this micro-analysis and what they're going to do with it. And hopefully this might be a useful contribution. In particular, it's allowed here to look at how non-managers, frontline workers and customers have an impact on enacting strategic aims, in part through upholding the moral order. and it makes a case for the multimodal studies of the workplace to understand the situated physical context of strategic work. That's me.
Thank you. Good. Well, Katie, invite you to keep the conversation going. We have some good time in which we can do that. Questions, observations? Yes, Tom.
Does your conclusion hinge on the assumption that these tour guides were aware of the organisation's strategy?
No, absolutely not. And in a sense, that's what's the most interesting point about it, is that they, in the, well, they don't actively think about that. When I interviewed them subsequent to the tours and in the way that they relate to what they do, they don't see this as being a strategic organisational activity. They see it as being important to the museum, but it's not expressed in the language or ideas of the museum strategy.
Ruth Parent?
I'd assume that museums would do things like diversity measurements by numbers, you know, ethnic background of people actually coming in.
Yeah.
So I can imagine the guys loving your findings, yeah? But how have the sort of more traditionally strategic levels of management responded? And, you know, do you get the kind of questions that a lot of us get, you know, you've not got numbers in this, for instance, it's just that tour guide, do you know what I mean? All of those kinds of issues.
What's interesting about that is that the museums are looking for ways to engage the tour guides and to get more people to be tour guides generally, so they're less concerned about the figures that go with this, and they're more interested in the way that it might provide a tool to encourage more people to become tour guides. So exploring the link further as opposed to necessarily closing it down. And from my understanding, lots of the way that they fill in the forms, the ways that they apply for funding, it's not all about quantitative measures. There's quite a lots of these ideas are quite qualitative, and so kind of that kind of expression isn't necessarily as problematic within the museum.
Ray Wilkinson, how is that?
Yeah, just a comment on image 3.3. One aspect about strategy or the kind of intelligence of the guide, perhaps. Using the indexical, that bit as an extension, it reminds me of something that Charles Goodman wrote a while ago about gestures, where actually the gesture of the nose, the person can't see the gesture.
Mm.
And they say something like, it was this wide.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Goodman writes is that the gesture is not expecting the gesture to be understood, it's an orientation of attention,
yeah,
by the listener. And I wonder, I think what I can see in the kind of slightly murky of your video.
Yeah, sorry, it's not better quality.
But I think what was happening, at least for some, so the group was quite diverse. And I think when the guy said that bit, some of the people started orientating towards, you know, looking around for what that bit would be.
Yeah.
So it focused the group as a group.
Yeah.
So that thing of like indexicality as not just pointing to something, but as an orientation of attention.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you get that a lot in the guided tour, that kind of ripple effect where no one's looking. You say something that clearly requires them to look at you for them to make an understanding of it.
Mm-hmm.
And progressively over the next few seconds, almost everyone turns to the guide.
Anna, I think you had your hand up.
Yeah, I don't know what the situation is in the UK, but in Sweden, guides are increasingly being replaced by these audio things where you walk around. Do you have a point on that from your research?
Yeah, so I looked at how lots of my findings suggest that you can't replicate these types of activities through the audio guide, because on the whole, without this kind of research, museums see what guides do as largely oral, as opposed to having an awful lot of pointing and that kind of thing. It's almost ignored. And when you look at guide training, it entirely thinks about what they say as opposed to what they do. Unless it's about fire exits, then it's focused on what they say. So from that point of view, this is interesting because it challenges the idea of audio guides, but it also potentially reveals some ways that you might be able to build some of these things into an audio guide by kind of doing meta talk. But the problem, of course, then is that you lose the flow of what you're saying.
Yes, topic.
Maybe perhaps relevant to Anna's point, it's worthwhile to mention that recently the Krulle Müller Museum in the Netherlands has invited a Dutch writer and poet to speak into these machines, and he makes great fun of all the objects of art. So instead of doing a real tour, he points to all kind of funny things in the and that's exactly the kind of thing that you were talking about in terms of doing education but also doing amusement. And well, he takes the amusement a bit more seriously than the education. But apparently there are options. I mean, that's what I mean to say. There are options for using these machines as well, and this method also for doing the kind of work that you were talking about.
Yeah, and there's also a real thing at the moment for kind of the anti-tour, or the tour of the thing that shouldn't be toured.
A lot
in kind of Edinburgh Festival, there's tours of things that shouldn't be toured. Kind of dark tourism is same idea, but taken in a different way. And kind of homeless tours and that sort of thing. It's revealing the nature of the city, the stuff that we haven't quite seen before. So it's not quite the same, but a similar kind of idea where you focus on the entertainment, the spectacle of it.
Eric, I think you...
Yeah, it was actually just comparing Tom's paper this morning with yours. So sorry, I thought about that, where I was thinking what was interesting in Tom's was that pursuit of did they know enough, what kind of response would come to show that they understood the implications of the thing they were being told, or had the answer to all, and so on. And the tour, the visitors, well, I don't know if they're customers or not, whether just visitors, customers, whatever they are, and the fact that not much really seems to be expected of them, nor do they seem to have that much at stake. They seem sort of quite hard to work with, but one of the things you highlight is that they do have some sort of strategic role. So I suppose if it's a question, it's what is that strategic role that customers have there, and what kind of responses do they make?
So this data, these three particular fragments, don't do an awful lot to develop the idea of the audience as important participants, but the kinds of things that they do, those what we might call back channels, are much more than back channels in this case, because the guide in a sense can't fulfil the aims of the museum until they know that the audience are listening and they're participating in the tour. So the audience do become more involved than I perhaps presented here. And actually, another paper that I've written is about the dialogue between the two and how the audience member do so much in terms of responding, asking questions, providing comments, smiling, turning their head. Where we sometimes miss out on that is that because we treat the audience as a lump, as opposed to seeing it as individuals, we assume that if everyone's not doing it, the audience aren't doing it. But actually what happens is this idea of the working audience, where one, two, three people are treated for the time being as the audience, which is enough to allow the tour to continue.
I think with that, we'll break for tea. Thank you very much.